If you'd like to turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you'll find that on page 807. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, starting to read at verse 1. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to marry. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am. But each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it's good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, I not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him, and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you, although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. Similarly, he who was a free man when he was called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brothers, each man, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation God called him to.
Thank you very much, Tim. Do you remember how chapter 6 ended? Paul writes, "You are not your own, you were bought at a price. Therefore, honour God with your body." A Christian is someone who's been bought at a price, someone who belongs to God. A Christian is someone who therefore says, yes, my body is not my own to do as I please with. It's his. It belongs to him. Therefore, honor God with your body. And you remember how we saw last week? That is a radical thing to say. The first century was rather like the 21st century in the sense of people thought that if you were into God, it meant you were into the kind of the spiritual world out there somewhere. That's why so many people today can't really see why Christianity would in any way be relevant. And they say, well, if you're into spiritual things, things out there, you know, that's fine. It's just, I'm not. It's not my thing. My life is very much about the kind of flesh and blood realities of relationships and the things at work and challenges in the community where I live and the election that's coming up and what's going on in Nepal. And you see, it sounds to people, when you talk about being into God, it sounds like you've got flesh and blood reality sort of here and you've got spiritual things over here. And there's this huge disconnect. And Paul says, no, that is not where the God of the Bible, that relationship with the God of the Bible leaves you, with this disconnect. Luke Ferry is a guy, he's a French professor of philosophy. He's not a Christian. He's written a brilliant book called A Brief History of Thought. And it's so interesting how he talks about the impact that Christian thought has made on the world. So, for example, in Greek thinking, Greeks thought in terms of hierarchy, not really in terms of equality. And it's Christianity, he argues, that laid the foundation for all human beings being equal. And in Greek thinking, flesh and blood doesn't matter very much. And he says it's Christianity that taught us the value of flesh and blood. So he says one can be a non-believer, but one cannot maintain that Christianity is a religion dedicated to contempt for the flesh. That is simply not the case. And he talks about how much kind of spirituality that throughout the history of the world has been about escape from flesh and blood realities. But the relationship with the God of the Bible, a relationship with the God of the Bible, is a relationship with the one who made flesh and blood, who took on in Christ flesh and blood. And therefore, relationship with him is never about running away from flesh and blood in some kind of spiritual zone. It's always about honoring him in the ordinary flesh and blood reality of life. See, that's why Paul is able to say this radical thing, honor God with your body. And that lays the foundation of what Paul goes on to talk about in the following chapters. He's talking about the flesh and blood realities of life. He's talking about marriage. He's talking about singleness. He's talking about people who fall out with one another. He's talking about what we think about the food we eat. He's talking about what we do with our money. And in all those situations, he says, look, Christian spirituality is never about running away from those things. It's always about how to honor God with our bodies in the midst of those things. And from what we pick up in chapter 7, verse 1, these are issues they have asked him about in a letter. And the first area he addresses are questions to do with marriage. And you might think, oh, I've come out this afternoon and I'm not married. This is not going to be relevant to me. What a, you know, could have. Well, next week we'll be talking about singleness. But the point is, we won't think clearly about singleness unless we have a clear view of what marriage is and what it isn't. Tim and Kathy Keller, in their really helpful book, The Meaning of Marriage, they say, single people cannot live their lives as singles without a balanced, informed view of marriage. If they do not have that, they will either over-desire or under-desire marriage, and either of those ways of thinking will distort their lives. So even if you're not married this afternoon, you need a clear sight of what marriage is. For your own sake, you also need it for the sake of others. Because church is family. And when two people are struggling in a marriage, it doesn't just affect them. It affects the whole family. We can't say, well, it's nothing to do with us. We are their brothers and their sisters. And we'll need to know how to support them and help them. And to do that, we need to understand some of the pressures and the challenges that are all tied up with being married. And the particular issue comes out in this phrase in verse 1, where Paul says, it is good for a man not to marry. Now, just look at the footnote there. And the footnote is actually a more accurate translation. It is literally, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And the footnote is, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. And the question is this a phrase the Corinthians are saying? Are they going around saying it's good for a man not to touch a woman? Or is this a phrase Paul has been saying? For my money, what he's doing here is he's continuing to do what he started to do last week, which he is clearing up their misunderstandings about what he's been saying. He's been saying, on the one hand, he's been saying, Christ sets you free from rules and regulations, freedom. On the other hand, do you remember, he's been telling them to steer clear of sexual immorality. And what happened in Corinth is what happens in every single culture. Half the people hear the freedom bit, and they hear it as license to do whatever we like. So don't get all moralistic on us. Don't get all hung up. That guy said, in Christ we're free. And the other half, they hear the warning about sexual immorality, and they hear it as a condemnation of sex. It must mean sex is bad. Sex is grubby. Steer well away. Paul is not saying sex is bad. We saw that last week. The issue is what you do with it. Do you remember last week's 18th century cream skimmer, which I don't think people were as excited about as I perhaps thought they would be? What if I give the cream skimmer to Fraser? I give it to Fraser, and Fraser starts whacking people over the head with the cream skimmer. What is the problem there? Is it that cream skimmers are bad? Cream skimmers are dangerous, and we should have nothing to do with cream skimmers because people just get hurt. No, the issue is what dear old Fraser is doing with the cream skimmer. He is whacking people over the head. That's why they're getting hurt. Use it for skimming cream. It is brilliant. It's wonderful. Okay? So that is what Paul is saying. He's not saying sex is bad. Sex is good. He's saying it was made for marriage. And in marriage, it binds people together at the deepest level. It's good. But use it for anything else. Use it for anything outside of marriage. And that's when people get hurt. That's when you're using the cream skimmer to whack them. And that's why he's both affirming sex but speaking against sexual immorality. And he then applies that basic principle to four different groups of people. And I must say, as I was looking at this during the week, I was so struck by how pastorally sensitive Paul is. Just watch how he takes God's truth and he speaks it very carefully into the different situations that people face. And I need to say, this is not a systematic treatment of everything there is to say about marriage. Okay, if you think that, you'll be very disappointed and confused. He's just speaking into particular areas of misunderstanding. And I need to warn you, he speaks very frankly. I'm going to need to speak very frankly too. The first group of people he speaks to is a married couple who want to honor the Lord. A married couple who want to honor the Lord. This is verses 2 to 6. Now, verse 2 has a long history of being misread. You see what it says? But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. And it has a long history of being read as, that if you, since there is so much immorality, you should get married. Marriage is the answer to sexual immorality. You know how when you're driving down a long, steep hill, and you know they have those escape lanes, you know, the little sandy tracks that in case your brakes fail and you lose control, you kind of pull into an escape lane, yeah? Down the years, some people have presented marriage as just a kind of sexual escape lane. So if you're out of control, you pull into marriage. That is a very unhelpful way of thinking about marriage on two levels. One, it makes marriage feel like it's kind of sub-spiritual. You couldn't control yourself, so, you had to get married. Secondly, if you're not married, and you do feel a little bit out of control, the temptation to sexual immorality is live. If you think marriage is the escape lane, all you do is you look for the escape lane. You're just looking for the escape lane the whole time. You're looking for marriage to be the answer. And what we'll see in this whole chapter, Paul is saying marriage is not the escape lane. It's not the answer. So he's not saying, because of sexual immorality, get married. He's saying something much more interesting. He's talking to people who are already married. See, he says, since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. That phrase, have his own wife, and each woman have her own husband is a phrase that refers to husbands and wives making love. Do you see? He's saying, I want you to avoid sexual immorality. Okay? And I'm talking to people who are single, and I'm saying to them, avoid sex, don't have sex. And he's talking to people who are married, and he's saying, avoid sexual immorality. If you're married, the way to avoid it is to have sex with your husband or your wife. You see? Since there is so much sexual immorality, he says, a married couple should make love. So you've got these married people who are going around and they're thinking, well, Paul says we should avoid all sexual immorality, and they're hearing that as sex is grubby. And if you're really spiritual, you wouldn't have sex. At very least, they're hearing it that sex is not very important. You know, it's kind of for emergencies only. And you think, really? People think like that in Corinth? Yes, and not just in Corinth, but in Bristol. Down the years, up and down the country, married Christian couples have picked up this idea that sex is something base. It's something to be embarrassed about. It's not really something to celebrate. It is just for emergencies only. And that is a recipe for sexual immorality. Paul comes back to it again in verse 5, because that is his issue here. That's his concern. The point is, marriage is not the kind of fail-safe answer to sexual immorality. Married people too face the danger of sexual immorality. They too need to avoid it. And the way to guard against it, if you're married, is to have a healthy marriage. And a healthy marriage is one that's along the lines of verse 3. Do you see what he says in verse 3? The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The husband has a duty, and the wife has a duty. And the language behind that phrase, duty, is the husband has a debt. They have a debt they owe each other. The husband owes it to his wife to make love to her. The wife owes it to her husband. Well, why? Why do they owe it to each other? And the answer is because of what marriage is. Verse 4, the wife's body doesn't belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but to his wife. First of all, notice the extraordinary equality here. In the ancient world, you were used to thinking about the wife as belonging to the husband, but the husband's body belongs to the wife. Extraordinary equality. But his point is, think of what marriage is. Do you remember last week? The two become one. So the husband says to his wife, not, this is my body to do with what I please. My body's not mine anymore. It belongs to you. It's for you. I heard of a man who really is a friend of a friend of mine, who apparently before he got married, he wasn't terribly great at brushing his teeth. It was one of his kind of foibles. He wasn't a great teeth brusher. And his wife, quite soon into their marriage, noticed this and put a little sign up in the bathroom saying, they're not your teeth anymore, they're mine, so please look after them. And that's right, she's understood something of marriage. As a Christian, my body belongs to God. It's for him. Yeah, and within marriage, my body belongs to my spouse. So it's to be used for them. And that's why he says, verse 5, do not deprive each other. Again, the word there, deprive, is steal. If you stop giving your body to your spouse, it's like you are stealing from them. You are taking from them something that is rightfully theirs. So do you see the picture that Paul paints of sex being used for what it was made to be used for? Sex within marriage. Marriage is all about giving yourself to the other person for life. And sex is the physical act that expresses what marriage is all about. Giving yourself totally to the other person for life. It's very striking, isn't it? It doesn't tie it to procreation. Sex isn't just about having children. It has a place in marriage as the glue that binds two people together on the very deepest and most intimate level. It's so countercultural, this picture, because we live in an age that where sex is all about what you can get. And Paul's saying, no, sex is about what you should give. And that's why he says in verse 5, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. It's a concession. As in, he's not saying you should deprive each other for a time. He's just saying, I understand for a time you might want to deprive each other. Friends, the honest truth is if you're married with young children and work is busy and there are jobs around the house that need doing, the two things that are really hard to find time for are what? Praying together and making love. And so what Paul is saying is there might be a season when you set aside an evening together to pray because it's not happening. But you do it by mutual consent. Of course you do it by mutual consent. Your body belongs to them. You can't decide about this alone. And you do it just for a time. Do you see? Then you come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. See, just for a time. Otherwise, if you stop making love altogether, you'll be vulnerable to Satan's temptations. You will lose control. You'll be vulnerable to finding what you need on the internet. You'll be vulnerable to the colleague who seems to pay you so much attention. Do you see? This is not his whole theology of marriage. He's not saying, this is why you should get married. He's talking to married couples who think there's something a little bit grubby about sex and who abstain in the name of being spiritual because Paul told us to avoid sexual immorality, or at least they're using being spiritual as a cover for their abstaining from sex. They're just saying, no, let's just pray together. You see? And it sounds so spiritual. Paul is saying, careful, this is a recipe for sexual immorality. So the application here is not to go home and think this verse gives me license to make demands on my spouse. It doesn't say, husband, demand that your wife fulfill her marital duty. It does not say that. The application is for both husbands and wives to give of themselves to each other. Do that, and amongst other things, you will protect each other from sexual immorality. Now, if you're not married and you're sitting here and you're squirming like mad, it may be you cannot imagine that a married couple need to be urged to make love. You're thinking, what? See, if you are single, you need to know the reality. Flesh and blood life in the ordinary world is a world where you are tired and where there are children running around and there are jobs that need doing and there are bins that need taking out. And you have to go to IKEA. And you have to pay the bills. And you have to have people over. See, it's a world where you get older. It's a world where you lose your hair. Where you lose your figure. Where you start to snore. And in the midst of all that, married couples stop making love. Or at least one of you does. And the danger is you kind of justify it with a kind of muddled spirituality that says, well, of course it doesn't really matter very much. I mean, it's just a bit earthy, isn't it? But remember what your marriage is. It's two becoming one. And sex is the glue that binds two people together at the very deepest level. And that's why you owe it to one another to make love. Now, it's one thing when one of you is ill. That is a different thing. That's why you made the vows in sickness as well as in health. But it's a very different thing when both of you or one of you just sort of doesn't feel like it. Paul is saying it's not about what you feel like. This is your sacred duty to one another. Do not deprive one another. This is not everything there is to say about marriage. But this is pastoral counsel that many in Emmanuel Corinth needed to hear. And I suspect there are many in Emmanuel Bristol who need to hear it too. Second group of people he speaks to are people who've been married. This is verses 7 to 9. Paul says, verse 7, I wish that all men were as I am, and we get from the end of verse 8, and he is not married. He's unmarried. Now, we can't know for sure, but given that most Jewish men married in their sort of mid-20s, and given Paul's position within the Jewish authorities before he was converted, there's a good chance he would have been married at some point. Maybe his wife died. Maybe she abandoned him when he became a Christian. Maybe she was part of the losing all things for Christ that he speaks of in Philippians. We can't know for sure. What we can know is he's not making his singleness the high point of godliness. When he says, I wish all men were as I am, he's not saying this is the gold standard. It's a bit like, it's the language he uses a little bit later on when he speaks about the spiritual gift of tongues. He says, I would like every one of you to speak in tongues. He's not saying, you should all speak in tongues. That's the gold standard. He's just saying, speaking in tongues is a blessing. And here he's just saying, look, being single as I am is a blessing. It's good. Do you see his pastor's heart? See, in the middle of affirming marriage, he doesn't want anyone thinking, ah, so what Paul's really saying is marriage is the answer. You've got to get married. See, he's saying, no, marriage is good, but it's not the answer. Singleness is good, as I'm single. You see how careful Paul is being? And our danger is we're so quick to land on saying one is better than the other. So some Christian cultures you get where singleness is seen as better. If you were really spiritual, you wouldn't get married. And other Christian cultures where marriage is seen as better and single people feel under enormous pressure to get married. They can't get invited around to anyone's house without being set up on a date. And both pressures are pastorally disastrous. The point is, verse 7, that each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Marriage and singleness are both gifts from God. And people want to know, well, how can I tell? How can I tell if I've got the gift of singleness? It's really interesting that he uses the same language that he uses about singleness. He uses that same language about marriage. There is the gift of singleness and there is the gift of marriage. How can you tell if you've got the gift of marriage? If you're married, you've got the gift. Because it is what God has given you. And what that means is, how do you know you've got the gift of being single? If you're single today, you've got the gift. That's what God has given you. I read somewhere that marriage is like a city under siege. Half the people are trying to get in, the other half people are trying to get out. And I know that many people who are single are miserable because they think marriage is the answer. If only I was married. You need to know there are many married people who are miserable because they are thinking, oh, if only I was single. That would be the answer, because marriage is hard. See, we tend to see our situation, whatever situation we're in, as the problem we have been dealt. And Paul says, no, whether you are single or you're married, the situation is a gift God has given you. And the point is, both are good gifts. Both are from God. Both are ways of honoring him. So as we'll see more in the rest of the chapter next week, he says, don't waste opportunities that he's giving you to honor him with the gift he's given you, sort of spending, wishing your days away, wishing you had a different gift. And the gift he's given you may not last a lifetime. I mean, even if you're married now, unless you and your spouse die in a car crash together, the chances are one of you will have to live many years single again. See, but the whole point, the issue is not marriage or singleness, but whichever situation you are in, honoring God with your body. So there are God-honoring reasons to stay single. There are. But if God gives you the opportunity, there are good God-honoring reasons to get married. And Paul doesn't... He wants to make sure people don't get married or stay single for all the wrong reasons. See, he doesn't want Emmanuel Corinth to be the sort of place where one option is seen as more spiritual than the other. And here he's talking to people who are in danger of staying single for the wrong reasons. Unmarried people. And I think the unmarried people here are people who maybe, like Paul, have been married before. You see, the word for unmarried there in verse 8 is a masculine word, unmarried men. And that seems to go with the widows. And it's actually later in verse 25 that he talks about people who've never been married before. So I think he's talking to people who have been married, but they're not married now. And Paul is saying that there is a lot going for staying unmarried as I am, but if, verse 9, if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it's better to marry than to burn with passion. Here is a man in his late 40s with three young children, and his wife died of cancer. And he meets a woman at church who has a little boy, and her husband was killed in a car crash a few years before. And both of them talk about how life as a single parent is hard, because it is. And they're struggling. And they miss being married so much. And they miss the intimacy they used to know. And they're spending more and more time together. And they get on really well. And they are, in Paul's words, they're finding it hard to control themselves. They would love to get married. They're aching to get married. And people in church are going around saying, yeah, of course, if you're really spiritual, you wouldn't feel the need to get married if you're really spiritual. And Paul is saying, no, marriage is not the answer to all our problems. Marriage is not even the answer to sexual immorality. But it is a way you can honor God with your body. It is good. So they should get married. Don't stay single for the wrong reasons. Third group of people he speaks to are those contemplating divorce. Verse 10, to the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. Again, this is not a whole theology of divorce. Please hear that. But what he's saying here does tie up with what Jesus says in Matthew 19. And what Jesus says in Matthew 19 is if you get what marriage is, you won't divorce, because marriage is about two becoming one, being joined by God. And Jesus says, those whom God has joined, no one should separate. Again, this is not everything there is to say about divorce. He's speaking into a particular pastoral context, but he's speaking into a context where they misunderstand what God thinks of the body. And when you misunderstand what God thinks of the body, you are more likely to go down the road towards divorce. Because you'll start thinking, of course, what God cares about is my heart. And I can divorce this woman and still love God. Or especially if you think, you know, sex is grubby or marriage is second rate, you can justify your divorce on grounds that, you know, marriage was getting in the way of serving the Lord and your relationship with Him. And you say, really? Do people say that? You'd be amazed at the number of people who neglect their marriages in the name of serving the Lord. They're so busy serving the Lord, they don't see He calls us to serve Him in their marriages. You'd be amazed at the number of conversations I have had down the years with people saying, do you know, I think my marriage is holding me back from serving the Lord. And I've prayed about this, and I think the Lord wants me to leave my wife or my husband. And sometimes it's because they want to give their lives to overseas mission, and she's holding me back, they say. Or sometimes they want to give their lives to serving the homeless, and they say, well, he's not interested. See, it sounds so spiritual. And if you've got a spirituality of escape from flesh and blood realities, then serving the Lord with this big idea, going overseas, will always sound more attractive than serving the Lord in the flesh and blood reality of a relationship with someone who is hard to love. And Paul says, I understand your marriage is hard, but that is the gift God has given you. It's the place He's called you to serve Him in, and it's the way He's going to make you more like Jesus. So don't divorce. Fourth person Paul speaks to is the person who is married to an unbeliever. It's clear from chapter 7, verse 39, that a Christian should marry a Christian. But in 12 to 16, Paul is talking into a situation where you've become a Christian, but your spouse hasn't. And it's hard. It's hard because following Jesus has given you a whole new reason for living. It means you and your spouse are kind of pulling in a different direction. And there are moments in your marriage when you really feel the pinch of that. You want to be back in time for church, but he doesn't. You want to read your Bible and pray with the children at bedtime, but she doesn't. You want to give your money to the cause of the gospel, but he doesn't. It's really hard. And Paul says that maybe there's nothing you can do. You're pulling in such different directions that your spouse leaves. But if they are willing to stay, as far as it depends on you, do not divorce them. You're not to break up the marriage, and you're not to behave in ways that break the marriage up. You're not to do that thing that Christians sometimes do, which is they leave their family to clear up the kitchen, and they say, of course, I'm off to a prayer meeting because I'm spiritual, you see, unlike you. And that's the subtext. But the whole point is real spirituality stays in the kitchen, does the dishes. And I think the particular worry comes out in verse 14, where he says, for the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they're holy. Now, it sounds like some of them are worrying that being married to a pagan would somehow make them unclean. The clue that is the issue is the language Paul uses about the children. He says, they are not unclean. You don't think of your children as unclean. They are clean in God's sight. They are holy. So he says, look, For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife. It's not that they make you unclean, rather you make them clean. Sanctified doesn't mean they've automatically become Christians. He says in verse 16 that they still need to be saved. But his point is, your marriage and your family is a real marriage in God's eyes. I think that's the sense of holy here. You are clean in the sight of God. You mustn't think of it as grubby or second rate. Verse 15 says, if they leave, let them. But we're called to live in peace. So if your marriage is peaceful, there's no reason to leave, because leaving will only make for a fight. And verse 16, anyway, how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? How do you know, husband, whether you'll save your wife? See, it will be hard. And our culture tells us marriage is all about our own personal fulfillment. So we think if it's hard, we owe it to ourselves to leave. And the Christian is saying, no, it's not all about me. It's about serving the Lord. And the best way I can serve him is to love my spouse, and to go on loving my spouse in the flesh and blood context of some very tough moments. Why? So that they become Christians. See, that's what I most long for them. So I'll stay. He's a great pastor, Paul. He recognizes that being married to someone who's not a Christian is really hard. And I think what he says just reminds us of the need to support people we know like that in our small groups. Affirm their marriages. Understand when they need to be at home, why they can't come to the prayer meeting, and not make them feel bad about it. I need to land. We're going to look at verses 17 to 24 a bit more next week. But they kind of bring this section to a close and then launch us in to the second half. So just for today, look at verse 17. Nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life which the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. Look at verse 20. Each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. Look at verse 24. Brothers, each man as responsible to God should remain in the situation God called him to. Do you hear the drumbeat? See, we think, if only the situation was different, then I would be happy. Then I could serve the Lord. But do you hear what Paul's saying? Remain. Remain, remain, remain in the situation God has called you to, put you in. Do you see how Christian doctrine and practical living are so interconnected? If we think our bodies don't matter very much, then when we are in situations that are hard, we will tend to walk away. We will tend to say, well, look, it'd be easier to serve the Lord somewhere else. And Paul says, yes, walk away from sin, flee. But these situations aren't sin, these are just hard. And the God of the Bible is the God who made flesh and blood bodies. He's the God who took on a flesh and blood body in Christ. He's the God who loved us so much that he didn't walk away. He came. He stepped into our messed up, hard world. So real spirituality is never to walk away. It is to remain, to stay. Use your flesh and blood body to serve him in the place that he's put you. See it as God's gift. He's given you this. This is where he wants you to be. This is his opportunity. He's given you to serve him. Stay and ask for his help to make you more like Jesus, that you would honor him in the place that he's put you. Let's pray. You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. Our Father, would you please show us more of what it means to live as those who belong to you, and to honor you in every situation that you have put us in. Amen. Do sit down. I'm afraid I realize I've slightly messed up here, which is I've clean forgotten to tee up someone else to ask the questions to me. So now the whole thing looks rigged because I'm going to select my own question. So I'm sorry about that. I'm going to also need to be really brief. That's another way in which I've messed up. So just to start by saying we're not going to be able to get through all the questions, but over tea, let's keep talking, and let's keep talking during the week. If something I've said has just got you really kind of thinking, I need to think more on that, please get in touch. Here are some questions. Let me try and answer them really briefly. What questions about the text? Why would Paul say the first sentence in verse 7, I wish that all men were as I am, if he didn't value singleness above marriage? read the whole chapter tonight, and you'll see the kind of way Paul is talking. We tend to go, right, if that is good, then everything else must be bad. And Paul is saying, no, there's such a thing as it's good in this situation, this is good. In this situation, this is good. And so he's saying, as far as he's concerned, oh, he thinks everyone should stay single. He's loving being single. But that doesn't mean it's right for everyone. See, there's value in being single, but there's value in being married. And that's the very pastorally sensitive way that Paul argues. Verse 9 says, burn with passion. This does seem to be talking about desire, physical desire. Is this true? If so, marriage seems to be the answer. Yes, I think it is talking about physical desire. But you see, again, it's quite specific. You're saying in that instant, people have been married before, getting married again, and they are really struggling with physical desire. You think it's not wrong to get married. Get married. Is in a culture saying we shouldn't get married, that's really insensitive. If everyone's going to say we shouldn't get married, unspiritual to get married, saying, no, that's a good reason to get married. It doesn't mean marriage is the answer to all sexual temptation, because look at the first section, talking to married people who still face sexual temptation. It's not the kind of the one-size-fits-all answer. He's saying there is a situation, and there are some people for whom it would be the right thing to do. But it's not for everyone. And nor is it the silver bullet for sexual temptation. We'll get onto that next week a bit more. Just quickly, but verse 14 says, does verse 14 mean the believer is saved through marriage to the unbeliever is saved? No, sanctified. It's a hard thing, that, but I think he means holy in the sense of clean. You're not to think your marriage is grubby and somehow not honoring to God. They do need to be saved. They're not all magically saved by being married because of verse 16. That's still a future possibility. That's what you're praying for. Some various people ask about verse 17, staying in your position. We can talk more about that next week. Here is just a good sort of thoughtful one to end with. I do feel as a married woman with children that if we'd remain single, we could do more for the Lord. Any thoughts? Again, we'll need to see the whole chapter, but when Paul talks about those questions of serving the Lord, but one of the ways we think is what the Lord's calling us to is ministry out there. And it's true that some of us are called to go overseas and go to hard places and all those kinds of things, but we mustn't despise the how radical it is to serve the Lord in the ordinary, everyday things of life and how important it is to serve our family. And our children, what could be more valuable than discipling our children? So I think we sometimes fall into this, if I was really keen to serve the Lord, I would do something else, something far away, something big. And actually, the Lord puts high premium on doing the ordinary things. And the ordinary things are really radical. They really matter to him because he is the God of flesh and body and of every moment and every detail. He's not just the God of the, sort of the abstract plan. I think we can be made to feel that, can't we? That's the issue. As a church, we sometimes make people feel that. If they're married, there's a sort of, you know, they're not really serving the Lord because they're just sort of fooling around, you know, with their family. Well, it's possible to have an introspective family. It spends all its time turning in on itself. But actually, family and nurturing family is ministry that God calls us to. So we mustn't devalue that. But I know that's a tussle, and we'll look more at it next week. I'll pause there for now, and we're going to need the Lord's help, which means it's great that we're turning to him in prayer, and Aidan and Claire Darley are going to come and lead us.